NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a special edition of Flight Safety Detectives. I'm Miles O'Brien, joined today by John Golia and Todd Curtis. And we have a little bit of a news scoop for you, so we'll get right to it. We're talking about the Dreamliner, the 787 from LATAM Airlines out of Chile, that was heading from Australia to New Zealand and over the Tasman Sea, encountered a precipitous drop. And folks, I will tell you this. If this is not a lesson for all passengers to always leave their seatbelts on when they're in their seat, I don't know what is. 50 people were injured, some of them seriously, as they were thrown around like rag muffins in that cabin and hitting on the ceiling. It was not a good scenario and created a lot of mystery and a lot of further controversy for Boeing, frankly, which is in the middle of a lot of issues surrounding its 737, 787, and overall quality control in its manufacturing processes. But John Golia is one of the most well-sourced individuals on the planet when it comes to this kind of stuff. And without further ado, burying the lead, John, tell us what you've heard about what is likely to have happened on this aircraft.
Well, you know, the airline industry is loaded with rumors and people talking about things they shouldn't be talking about. And what's been circulating around airline people right now, and it's unsubstantiated, but it is very plausible, is that during flight, a flight attendant came into the cockpit. Not clear if that was required because one of the crew members left to go to the bathroom. So there's some unanswered questions there. But any event, the flight attendant entered the cockpit, and in the course of kibitzing with the captain, managed to hit the switch, the power seat switch for the captain's seat. And apparently the way he was twisted in the seat, maybe turning around to talk to her or half looking at her, or he, we're not sure even the gender, the seat went forward and jammed his body between the seat and the control column, pushing the column forward. A little bit of motion on that column will disconnect the autopilot. And then without the resistance from the autopilot on the control column, while that push was continuing, would definitely put the airplane in a nosedive and, you know, resulting in people bouncing off the ceiling.
All right. I know you have a little piece of video which will help us understand, because when I think about the adjustment buttons for a seat, you think about it down to the side, right? Usually. But in this case, there's actually a button kind of by the headrest, and that makes it easier for a crew member to adjust the seat when they're trying to get into the aircraft in case it was left forward for some reason.
Right. What happens oftentimes, Miles, is, you know, pilots come in with their bag, catalog bag, essentially, their leather bag, not their clothes, but it's the manuals that they have to fly the airplane, assorted material. And that usually goes on the left-hand side or the right-hand side, depending if you're the captain or the co-pilot. And oftentimes you'll have them push the seat all the way forward so that they can manage putting that in place from behind the seat. And then they move the seat backwards so that they can get into the seat. And that was always a struggle. I've moved that seat repeatedly myself. And you have to bend over to get the control lever. And if you're standing at an awkward position, and you're oftentimes banging into some of the switches, which can cause a problem. So they move the switch to the, what you said, the upper rear of the back of the seat. And now you can stand there and move the seat forward and back without struggling, put your bag in, then bring the seat backwards and climb in, and then operate it from the other switch while you're seated. So it's a convenience item. But I don't think anybody ever expected that this kind of event would have occurred. Now, it would not have occurred if the captain's legs were not out of position, so to speak. Because he had moved his leg, essentially both legs on one side of the column, now that puts a leg between the seat. You may recall that the seat has a cutout in it for the column to come into. All right, so now it puts a leg in between that. And now if you get it jammed, you've got a problem.
All right, so take a look at this video. And what you see is a button that is behind the top of the headrest area. And it's kind of unclear what that is looking at it. But if you push on it, what you'll see is the seat can move forward or backward. Now, John, explain that idea is just to make it easier, as you say, to put the bags and so forth in and then get it out. Otherwise, what you would have to do is kind of reach down kind of underneath it for the switches that would be convenient if you were seated, right?
Right. Correct. So you would be leaning over the pedestal and leaning over the seat, the potential for your head to hit any of the switches on the overhead. And I kind of remember that a switch getting broken once because of that. But that's neither here nor there. It's possible to hit the switches in the overhead as you're doing it. And it's always been an issue with egress for the crew. So that the manufacturer has changed the arrangement of the buttons, put an additional button on the back of the seat to allow either one of the crew members to move his seat all the way forward, put their bag on the left or right side, and then bring the seat back so that they can climb in.
All right. That's pretty straightforward. It's straightforward, and it's it takes me back to Fate is the Hunter, the 1964 movie, where they finally determine it's the coffee cup on the console of the instrument panel which causes this calamity. It just goes to show you, in aviation, very little things can really bite you. But I imagine, John, wouldn't you suppose, and Todd, in this case, that if the flight attendant was in there, there's a good chance that the other crew member was out in the cabin going to the bathroom or whatever. Because I think if you had had the other crew member there, they could have counteracted this problem somehow or at least helped with the seat.
Well, this is something that we're going to find out fairly soon, because although this was a flight going from Australia to New Zealand, the New Zealand authorities have announced that the Chilean authorities, which is the country of registration, is actually taking over the investigation. And I had some concerns. Well, how good are they? I actually looked at the record of their version of the NTSB, and they're very, very good at giving detailed analyses of fairly small events, sometimes that wouldn't even make it to an NTSB investigation. So I have confidence that this event will be thoroughly investigated and we'll have full details as to who was in the cockpit, who did what, whether this was a potential design issue, et cetera.
You know, Todd, we just raised the issue about unintended consequences of things in the cockpit. Miles, you mentioned the coffee spill on the pedestal that messed up some switch activation. Todd, give us a minute, because I know you worked in certification. Give us a minute about what happens during the process of designing and thinking through an airplane when these sort of fringe issues come up.
Well, during the development process, and I was involved with the development process of the 777 at Boeing almost 30 years ago now. It's, as you can imagine, a very complex process. And the designers might think of a lot of things, but during the manufacturing or during the latter part of the design process especially, some things may come up. In fact, many things come up. And if there is a potential safety issue, let's say theoretically one can accidentally hit a switch and move the seat in the cockpit, and one recognizes that, well, you can bring it up to management and make the case that some things should be changed to keep this from happening during the life of the airplane. The challenge is there might be dozens, if not hundreds, of these things bubbling up all over in all parts of the company during the development process. And it's a question of, can you and your organization make an argument that will actually make change happen, whether it's a procedural change, a physical change on the aircraft, or a complete redesign of a system or subsystem? And frankly, in most cases, those battles get lost because there are just too many competitors and too many good ideas to be followed up on. And who wins is often a case of internal marketing.
That's fascinating.
Interesting.
It would be really hard, you know, for you. Let's say you had been in the 777 and said, you know, we really shouldn't put this switch on the seat because somebody could lean over. And they would have said, you know, we have to think about bigger issues here, Todd, you know. And in the truth of the matter is there are scenarios where things that are completely innocuous can lead to real trouble. So it's a series, you know, any engineering enterprise is a series of trade-offs and compromises. And this is kind of the nub of it. If you really went through every one of those people raising their hand and saying, you know, that switch might lead to, you know, an unexpected nosedive, you would never release an airplane to the market, would you?
No. And in most cases, you might think it's a good idea. You might think this is obvious, but do you have facts and data to back it up? And obviously with a brand new aircraft design, you don't have an historical background on that aircraft to go to. So then you might have to get creative, which I had to do on more than a couple of occasions. It's like, well, this is similar to a system on these other aircraft models. What do we have in the records, our records, outside records, et cetera, that speaks to this particular kind of design in this new aircraft coming up with the same problem? Then you might have a leg to stand on. It might be able to convince the next higher level of management to go forward. But then again, there's the level after that and the level after that and the level after that. But hey, you have to start somewhere. And it's usually a fairly long involved organizational, I wouldn't say fight, organizational negotiation going on. Will this change happen? And what kind of change will it be?
Well, so John, if you were sitting on the NTSB right now and this one landed on your desk and the conclusion was this was, you know, the crew member inadvertently activating this switch, what would you do? Is this something where you'd recommend an AD or some sort of change in procedure, or would you ask Boeing to change the switch?
Well, actually, I was involved with one very similar. It was a crash in LaGuardia in 1989, if I remember right, involving a 737. And what we believe, the airplane sat on the gate for 8 hours because of bad weather. Crew was on and off the airplane. Many people were in and out of the cockpit. We believe at one point of time, somebody was sitting in the observer's seat, which is behind the captain, and put his foot up on the center pedestal. Very common thing to do. And his foot slid across and hit the rudder trim switch and moved the rudder trim in full deflection in one direction. When the airplane departed, that wasn't picked up by the flight crew. As he went down the runway gaining speed, he couldn't control the airplane down the runway. He decided to stop and ran out of runway and ran off the end of the runway and hit a bunch of lights that were on the approach pier to the runway.
And I believe one of our earlier shows was about that 737. I think it was a Dash 400 event. So I'm going to flash on the screen, for those of you watching the video, the audio version, I'll flash on the screen the promo shot from that. And you can look that up and watch that show as well.
All right, so out of that, at that occasion, Boeing changed the knob to a round one where you couldn't move it if you put your foot up there. You couldn't move it inadvertently. A really simple fix to eliminate that problem ever happening again. So in this particular case, if this proves to be accurate, the story that's floating around, unsubstantiated, proves to be accurate, then the fix will be to change that switch in some way where you can't lean on it. So instead of having essentially a press to operate switch, it may be a real left to right movement switch. Just a different type of switch would solve the problem. Not a big deal.
Right. Or guarded in some way, some way to make sure you just don't lean on it and cause trouble. But it's fascinating, isn't it? How these little things can be so important in aviation.
And you can't underestimate the importance of the media attention this got right off the bat. And because this is something that was basically flashing all over the world, the people inside the aviation business who are concerned with this will be aware of this. We're probably looking out for the results from a Chilean investigation. And if you have several major players like the European authorities or the U.S. authorities say, hey, a change should happen, it's very likely it will happen throughout the fleet around the world.
You know, Todd, you just touched on something that affects both of the issues that we're going to talk about today, plus many others. And that is the mainstream media. Right now, everything that's going on a Boeing manufactured airplane is Boeing's fault. Right. And, you know, they don't maintain it. Boeing doesn't maintain the airplane after it leaves. Right. The operators do. So if the operator is having a lapse in their maintenance department and something goes bad, mainstream media today will say Boeing did this and Boeing's airplanes that, when in fact, it's just piling on. And it really isn't Boeing's fault. There are, well, trust me, Boeing has enough problems that they're responsible for. But I just shake my head sometimes, not only about what we're seeing recently, but the two crashes of the MAX. Both of them were pilot errors and operating errors of either the company or the pilots. And we're going to go through that flight recorder in the near future on the Ethiopian crash. We're putting that together now. But I firmly believe that both of those crashes were not Boeing's fault. It was poor pilot training, poor procedures from both companies, and we'll go through that.
Interesting.
Like I said, Boeing has got enough dirty hands in a lot of different areas to be accused of various and assorted things. But they're not responsible for the product for 20 years after it's built.
We'll also have some comments about the media, both traditional and alternative, in the next story we're going to cover, which is something that happened in the U.S. And, you know, Miles, you can take it away and describe what we see in the video here.
This is your airplane, Todd, Boeing 777 departing SFO on its way to Tokyo. And not long after departure, you know, we live in a world, as you well know, where everybody's on camera all the time, or so you must presume. And there is a whole subculture of individuals called plane spotters who spend an awful lot of time shooting pictures of airplanes arriving and departing airports all over the world. And as it happens, it appears this particular plane spotter got a very lucky shot of this 777 just about to tuck its main gear in, and one of those 255-pound wheels bouncing off and ultimately landing in an employee parking lot and doing a number on a car or two. Fortunately, nobody injured. So there you have it. A wheel comes off a Boeing. And this goes to your point, John. We've had a Boeing taxi off a runway, probably pilot error. We had a compressor stall and a fire, probably the result of CFM, the manufacturer of the engine, not Boeing. There was a hydraulic failure on an Airbus of United that they were trying to lump into this, which I thought was interesting. And in this case, you've got a wheel that comes off a 777 that's 20 plus years old. Folks, that's not Boeing's fault. That is a maintenance issue. And John, you know a little something about this, don't you?
Yes, I do. You know, I have been involved in this industry a long time, and I have seen quite a few wheels come off airplanes. It's not a regular occurrence, but when you've been around as long as I have, you can see a bunch of them. And in this particular case, the 777 has different weights to different models of that airplane. What I discovered was the bearings on the wheels. The inner bearing is the same number for both wheels, both airplanes. The outer bearing is not. So this error could be as simple as the wrong bearing, which looks the same, dimensionally is the same, be installed in that position improperly. Well, of course, we can't leave out the possibility of the last person to change the wheel making a mistake on installation. Unless it was just changed in San Francisco, that's not very likely. So either way, it could be a maintenance error in the wheel shop, and some airlines contract that out to specialized wheel shops, or it could be installation error on the part of the mechanic. But it could be as simple as having the wrong wheel bearing by part number installed on this wheel.
And I have a message for the NTSB on this one. This is a relatively minor event, which might generate an incident report. I hope it does. And I hope if you do have an incident report, you have volumes of information in the public docket so that we can answer these detailed questions and to the benefit of anyone who's operating a 777 and to allay any concerns that passengers and people who fly these for a living, flight attendants and pilots may have in the aircraft. So please do a thorough job.
Yes, maintenance people should double check and double check again what they're putting on the airplane, but sometimes time doesn't commit. Now on the wheels, let me clarify something on the wheels. The wheels come out of the shop with the bearings installed. So it's not a question of the person, the mechanic that you see when you're looking out the window of your airplane or out the window of the terminal that's changing the wheel. He's got the wheel assembly, has got all those pieces with it. So if it's the wrong bearing, it's likely coming from the shop like that. Because it takes too much time. Remember, airlines are looking for on-time departure. So the pieces that you get, the bits and pieces, are as assembled as possible so that the changing replacement of the part during the operating day takes the minimum amount of time. So it's most likely that bearing, if it was in fact the wrong bearing causing this event, came out of the shop someplace where the wheel was. You know, what happens is the wheel is disassembled, the worn tire is removed and sent to a company that puts new rubber on it. It's a recap tire. And another wheel is put on, reassembled, they inspect the bolts, they inspect the two pieces of the wheel using modern equipment to make sure there's no cracks. And the bearings have been cleaned, inspected, re-lubricated, they're put in, they're retained. Most of the time, the inner one's retained with a big snap ring, so it's not coming out. And the front one is ready to go on the airplane. It's usually a little looser. And quick, get it done. The assumption is that it's coming out of the shop properly assembled, ready to go. So sometimes that's not the case. And that may be the case here.
Well, I promise to give another point or two about the media. The media, when we mention the media, in the modern era, we have the traditional media we all know, CNN, BBC, etc. Then we have literally millions of people around the world who could be in a position, either because they're doing it all the time, like the plane spotters, or happens to be a circumstance, like someone sees an airplane on the side of the runway. They post it on social media. We find out about it. 30 years ago, we would not have found out about most of these, but indirectly. For example, the tire falling off of an aircraft, sure, it might have been in the world of the aviation media, but not the general media. So for those of you out there who are putting stuff out there, responsibly that is, keep up the good work. Speaking personally, I've been doing it since, oh my gosh, 28 years ago, I first started putting things online about aviation. And there were only a handful of us out there then. But now, if you have a phone, if you have a podcast, go for it.
Yeah, but they have to be accurate. Boy, I see so much that's inaccurate.
Well, like I said, do it responsibly.
When Todd started, he used the town crier to go, "Hear ye, hear ye." It's been a long time. So I will say this, though. United has had a bad stretch over the past week, and much is being made about that. And, you know, there are just bad stretches of luck. These things are all up over the map. You've got a pilot error incident taxiing off a runway. You've got the engine incident. You've got the wheel, you got a hydraulic, you got all these things. It's very difficult to connect all these dots, except to say maybe it's bad luck. But I will ask you this point, gentlemen. Do you think aviation writ large is hurting on so many fronts because of the lack of experience? What the brain drain that has occurred post-pandemic? And could that be what we're seeing here?
I think there's a little bit of that occasionally. I don't think you can blame everything that we've been seeing lately on that. But there is some of that. You know, I'd be interested to see the skill level of the mechanics to change that wheel last and when it was changed and where it was changed. So, but I'm not ready to jump into that all or nothing wagon on the experience level, but it does play a role sometimes.
And I'd like to jump in and say that there are several moving parts here. One of the moving parts, and one I've experienced most directly, is the informational part. There are things that are available at the touch of a button that would have been almost impossible to get 20 or 25 years ago. So if something happens somewhere in the system, let's say there's a report written, instead of it being on a dusty library shelf and you have to figure out which library in the country has it, you go to a website, you can download it, the information's in your hand. You can start making changes without waiting for it to bubble through the system. So yes, there might be experience issues and brain drain issues, but the information issue we have is there's a lot of it. And we in the industry have to understand, how do we use it to our advantage?
You know, and the other piece of the media is, you know, they're focused on Boeing right now. Everything is Boeing's fault. But you mentioned it yourself, Miles, in the beginning about the hydraulic issue that was on an Airbus, right? There are other issues that occur constantly in aviation, constantly, involving every type of airplane, but the press never reports them. I mentioned the number of times that I've been involved with airplanes that lost a wheel. They never made it. None of those ever made the news, right? They were just, like Todd said, inside aviation, they were talked about, but never outside. Not because somebody was trying to suppress it, the press wasn't interested in it. But right now, because of all the issues we've had the last 4 or 5 years involving Boeing, everybody's hyped up about going to Boeing. This plug door has got everybody going like crazy. And, you know, it's going to boil down to probably a simple mistake in process in the factory.
And I have a very, very graphic example of things that don't make it to the broader world. Here's an event, I'm flashing some pictures up on the screen for those of you watching the audio version, of an event that happened in the town of Sholo, Arizona. This is about 15 years or so ago. Never showed up in an NTSB report, never showed up as an FAA incident. Basically, a large bird flew into the windscreen of a cargo aircraft that had a single pilot in it. Totally wrecked the screen, all sorts of blood and guts inside of it, and the pilot landed safely. Because the pilot landed safely, no one heard about it. I happened to hear about it because John and I were both involved in bird strike issues with aircraft, and it kind of surprised me that this never got written up anywhere. So again, if you don't like looking at blood, please don't look at the video, but this is something that did not end up in anybody's database.
Well, it's clear we're focused on aviation right now, and I would caution my fellow journalists not to connect dots which shouldn't be connected and not to create unscientific trends just because 4 or 5 happenstances seem to have occurred within the reasonable recent memory. It's bad journalism, it's sloppy, and it doesn't do anybody any good. There are some serious problems at Boeing, there are problems in aviation, but lumping a lot of stuff together that doesn't have anything to do with each other for the sake of getting some clicks, to me, is not responsible journalism. So,
no, but I like clicks.
With that, I think we should do some last words. Todd, why don't you go first with the last word?
Well, these two events are examples of events that happen on a regular basis, which fortunately got a lot of public attention. But just as fortunately, this gets attention inside the business, even if the public never hears about it. And when these things happen, it leads to people waking up, taking notice, making changes if necessary, and moving forward. And I hope that's the case with these two events.
John.
Okay, so I have a couple last third words. The first one is, both of these events, we talk about possible circumstances. We're not speculating, but we're talking about what's really possible to have occurred. So just keep that in mind when you say it, especially with the seat, right? There's nothing official to say anything about that, the cause of that event. But we thought that that was a quite interesting possibility of an inadvertent act having an impact on an in-flight airplane. And also on the wheel, we talk about the possibilities of what could have caused it. We're really not going way out speculating and saying what it is, but those are possibilities. And as I always do in closing the show, all of us that fly, well, I don't fly anymore, but all of you that fly, if you're going to go flying, do a very good thorough pre-flight before you get to the airport. pre-planning before you get to the airport. Do it again when you get to the airport. Do a thorough pre-flight of your airplane, including touching your flight controls in the airplane. Nothing to catch you. Focus better than touching something and looking at what you're touching. And when you get in the air, put your head on a swivel. There's a lot of airplanes out there and a lot of low-experienced pilots trying to join the ranks of veteran pilots. So pay attention, please. And please, please fly safely.
And I would just add as my final thought, if you're a passenger on an airliner and you're in your seat, please keep your seatbelt buckled. There are 50 people right now, bumps and bruises and could be worse, who would attest to the fact that that's an important thing to do. And it's really foolhardy to be flying along without being buckled in. So by all means, buckle up always. And thank you for joining us on this special edition of Flight Safety Detectives.
Thank you for checking out our show. We really value our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you and how much you like it. So please give us 5 stars in your podcast platform.
We want to keep in contact with you. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're on YouTube, we're really working on growing the channel, and it helps if you all send in comments. Please do that, and we read all the comments.
And be sure to subscribe. Remember, if you're in the market for aviation insurance, you can save 5% with Avemco just by mentioning our show. Visit them at www.avemco.com. That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detective. Until the next episode, fly safe.